I'm Chris Nicholson. I was a human rights lawyer in South Africa fighting for the victims of apartheid. In 1995, I was made a judge, and then I retired in 2010. And so far, I've written 9 books, including a play. So my life story is really trying to fight the bad guys as a human rights lawyer and what they might have called an activist judge.
This latest book of yours, Who Really Killed Chris Haney? Who was Chris Haney?
Chris Haney was a major struggle hero in South Africa who grew up in the Eastern Cape, and he then was arrested for various activities against the apartheid government, and he went into exile and later led trying to take on the apartheid forces. He then came back to South Africa in 1990 and was shot and killed on the 10th of April 1993. He was going to be, I think, the follower of Nelson Mandela. He was hugely admired, in fact, adulated in South Africa. And unfortunately, he was gunned down during the Easter weekend of 1993.
Was he actually at an event of some sort, or was he picked out? How was he killed?
It was the Easter weekend. It was the Saturday, you know, sandwiched between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. So he was at home. He had gone to a local cafe, tea room, to buy a newspaper and some groceries. And when he just got home, a car went by, a man came out, or there were possibly two gunmen who gunned him down at about 10 o'clock on that day.
Can you just give us something of the flavour of South Africa in 1993 when this happened? Because I think it's kind of gone up and down in terms of lawlessness and these sort of political killings. So what was the situation in the early 1990s?
In the early 1990s, the various parties, including the African National Congress and the ruling Nationalist Party, were jockeying for position for new non-racial elections, which finally took place on the 27th of April 1994. At that time, obviously the apartheid regime was trying to secure a sort of government that wouldn't be a one-person, one-vote government, and they were hoping possibly for something in which the whites still dominated the elections. Haney was fighting for a socialist state. He was a great believer in the Freedom Charter. That was a document which was produced in 1955 at Cliptown in South Africa, and it was the blueprint for the new South Africa from the ANC's point of view. It called for a nationalization of industries, and it called for a redistribution of the wealth of South Africa, you know, amongst the poor Africans, who were 87% of the population at that time. So he was seen as a very radical person, and the ANC was divided into two factions. He led the more militant socialist faction, and there was a more moderate, capitalist-orientated faction, which was led by Thabo Mbeki and other members of the ANC. So there were these factional divisions within the ANC, and of course a huge hatred by the apartheid regime for Chris Haney, because he stood for what they dreaded. That was a redistribution of the wealth of South Africa, and punishment of the apartheid perpetrators of crimes with Nuremberg-type trials.
As for Chris, what had been his big achievements then, political achievements, and how had he etched his name into the minds of South Africans?
He was seen largely as the successor to Nelson Mandela, and after his death, I'd just like to quote what Nelson Mandela said at a commemoration of Chris Hani. He said, and I quote, "The fateful day of Chris Hani's brutal murder is indelibly etched on the hearts of all freedom-loving people, and no one will be satisfied until the truth about his death is known." So my book was really an attempt to solve the problem of who was really behind the shooting of Chris Hani. Two people were charged with his murder, a Polish citizen who had come to South Africa called Janusz Walusz, and Clive Darby Lewis, who was English-speaking, right-wing South African. So what everybody was really trying to find out was who were the puppet masters of these two? Who were the people who really were behind the killing of Chris Hani? So I investigated that particular riddle.
Now, look, what often happens in these assassinations, this is an assassination we're talking about here, it's a very important political killing, something like, I would argue, what happened to Princess Diana. You know, these sorts of things, which are at the top levels of society within, you know, literally the potential presidents, royalty, this sort of thing. So normally when this sort of thing happens, Chris, you've got an official story which is rolled out almost immediately to the press, and then you start to realise, well, this doesn't quite make sense, that doesn't quite make sense, or else, as may be in your case, it'd be interesting to hear, there are puppet masters behind the scenes. So can you try and do what Nelson Mandela requested for us now and solve that mystery? We know maybe who pulled the trigger, but who was behind the pulling of the trigger?
Yes, it's actually, Tony, a fascinating story in the sense that the two, that is Janusz Walusz and Clive Darby Lewis, applied for to our Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, if you told the whole truth and your act, your murder, had a political motive, you were entitled, you know, to be released from the charges. In other words, you know, you wouldn't be jailed any longer.
Well, that's a bit like what they call turning Queen's evidence, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So you were entitled then to be freed of the charges. Now, when he was applying for this indemnity from the charges, a researcher was given the file from the intelligence agencies, and in the file were 12 documents, but none of them really related to Chris Hani. They actually related to the killing of Patrice Lumumba and Dag Hammarskjöld. And they all were under the logo of an organization called the South African Institute of Maritime Research, SIMAR. And the fascinating part is that that organization had as its logo a lady stretching out her arms, which was the image that was on the prow of the sailing ships, the Cutty Sarks. So this lady who found these documents took them to Archbishop Tutu, who held a press conference. And then nothing really came of that press conference. But Susan Williams, you probably know the historian who's written a number of books, she took up the tale and she found out that SIMAR was headed by some conservative British politicians. And in the end, within 3 weeks of Chris Hani's murder, a magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, which is produced in America, that's within 3 weeks of his killing, wrote an article, "Did British Intelligence Kill Hani?" And in the end, they came to the conclusion that the South African Institute of Maritime Research was behind the killing of Chris Harney. And they said that that Institute of Maritime Research was a front for British intelligence, MI6.
Before you carry on, can you just explain, because you just dropped the name of Lumumba, Patrice Lumumba, another very famous African leader who was assassinated.
Yes. So, in my book, I try to link six murders. Those are the murders of Chris Harney at the end. But I start with Patrice Lumumba, and I deal also with Dag Hammarskjöld, Olof Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister, Bernt Carlsson, who was Administrator General for Southwest Africa, as Namibia was called, and an advocate, Anton Lebowski. And using what in the law we call similar fact evidence, I tried to tease out a connection between those people and Chris Harney. And what was happening, if your listeners recall, was that Lumumba was trying to redistribute the Congolese wealth in the early 60s. And Dag Hammarskjöld was sent by the United Nations. He was Secretary General to try and help Lumumba redistribute the wealth there. His plane then crashed. So these killings of Lumumba, Patrice Lumumba and Dag Hammarskjöld, are dealt with in great detail in these 10 documents that were in a file that referred to Chris Harney. So I'm suddenly thinking that there seems to be a link between these six people who, at the time of independence, are trying to redistribute the wealth, and there seems to be a conspiracy by forces, dark forces, to make sure that they don't survive and that they don't rule their countries. In other words, the wealth doesn't get redistributed. So those were the lines that I followed in the book.
Okay, so who was behind SIMAR? Was this something which was just South Africa? You dropped in there, British intelligence, MI6, I suppose you're talking about.
That's right. Yes, so what I was quoting was this American magazine, and I was fortunate enough to find a whole cache of documents in one of our libraries, which were the documents of this outfit called SIMAR. And so I analyzed them very carefully in my book, and they seem to set out how this organization seems to have been plotting and achieving the killing of these people. So I tend to link the killing of Harney and others with intelligence agencies and corporations, because it seemed to me that the corporations were very keen that these various individuals didn't survive long enough to redistribute the wealth amongst the population.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like a basic kind of neo-colonial program where you say, yes, you can have your independence, and everyone's has a kind of independence day. They all cheer and they all shout. But it's as soon as there's different figures who are vying to take over the nation, it's very important that it's the more conservative types, the ones that don't want to have any kind of social programs to redistribute wealth, as you put it. The socialist ones die and the rest survive.
That seems to be it. So with the Chris Harney matter, the killer, this Janusz Wolish, the man with the Polish origins, drove a motor car which was provided by one of the captains of industry in South Africa, a man by the name of Peter Jackson. And in the police file in the Chris Harney matter, there is an instruction that the police are not to investigate this captain of industry, Peter Jackson. So that seems to me to be another connection with the corporate world. And they, of course, have had their motive, because Chris Harney was going to carry out the, you know, what the Freedom Charter suggested, which was a redistribution of wealth or nationalization, you know, of industry and land and that in South Africa. So they obviously had a very, very clear motive for getting rid of Chris Hani. And it seems to me, if one looks at the other people I've mentioned, this Bernd Carlson was, there's a fascinating story about him, because he was the Administrator General of Southwest Africa, which was later Namibia, and he was trying to carry out a law of the United Nations which said that any of the diamonds or minerals that were taken out of Namibia from the 70s onwards had to receive the permission of the United Nations, and they didn't. And so those companies were being sued by this committee of the United Nations, led largely by Bernd Carlson. And he was then lured to London. He should have flown from Belgium to New York, and he was lured to London, and then he landed on the plane, which the Pan Am 103, which crashed in Lockerbie. So there's a fascinating story about Bernd Carlson and whether he was the real victim of the Lockerbie crash.
Or you mean the target? But hang on, you said he was going Didn't you say he was going to London? I mean, the plane refueled at London and then carried on, didn't it? And that's right. When it crashed.
He was heading to New York to sign these accords, you know, that were going to lead to Namibian independence. And instead of flying from Brussels to New York, he was persuaded to fly via London. So it's such a fascinating story, because if he was the true target on the Lockerbie plane, that explains a lot of why, you know, these various series on Lockerbie and that are maybe a false trail. Because it seems to me that various people luckily didn't get on the Lockerbie plane. You know, the tennis player Mats Wilander luckily didn't get on the plane. But the South Africans, you know, Pik Botha, the South African military, you know, the generals and the intelligence people, and Pik Botha, the Minister of External Affairs, they were warned not to get onto that flight, which eventually crashed over Lockerbie. So you see a South African dimension warning the South Africans not to get on the flight, but allowing this Bernd Carlson, who was bringing a big case against the corporates, to get on the flight and then to die in the fiery death.
Well, it's not at all impossible. I think it would be useful, because, of course, it was the Libyans that were accused of this. If you could just explain what the root of this Lockerbie Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988 was. Because I know it stopped off in London, it was heading to New York. Where did it start? Where were the possible transit points, stop-off points for this flight?
Well, I think it started in London, you know, and it was going to go to New York. It was a Pan Am 103, a regular flight. So the luggage was put on at Heathrow Airport.
And hang on. I think we just need to correct that, because Pan Am Flight 103 was actually from Frankfurt to Detroit via stopover in London and New York City. So it took off from Frankfurt in Germany, landed in London Heathrow, and then it also had another stopover in New York City before it was supposed to finish its journey in Detroit.
Tony, you're absolutely right. It was Frankfurt to London to New York. Is that right? So that is exactly right. So
to be clear, so it wasn't actually even at its cruise altitude, because it was flying up England, up to Scotland, and it was just about a sort of take off across the Atlantic when this bomb went off in the aircraft. So the suspicion may be that the bomb has been put off, especially if it's an altitude-sensitive bomb, possibly in London. So I don't know if you managed to dig that down that deep. I mean, of course, this points to it possibly not being a Libyan, but a British person that put this bomb on the plane. So what have you found out about that?
Well, it's the finger of suspicion seems to point to the South Africans, and certain mysterious forces in the intelligence branch of the South African apartheid system. So it seems to me that there's quite a lot of evidence that they were responsible. And I mean, why would they warn the South Africans and nobody else on the plane? So that in the end, 270 people died, but the South Africans then caught a different flight. So one wonders why they were warned and nobody else, which means the South African intelligence community must have known that the bomb was on the plane, and yet they didn't warn the other passengers.
So have we got any clues as to who? Because one thing I can remember from the documentaries about Lockerbie is the very suspicious breach of the fence around Heathrow Airport on the same day the flight took off. So someone had managed to get through the fence, so that possibly could have been the bomber that managed to get in and put the bomb on somewhere along the route, maybe bribed someone just to be quiet, put this bag on and ask no questions, you know, this sort of thing. And so have we got any clue as to what the mechanism and who it was that actually did that?
Well, the finger of suspicion points to South African agents. And, you know, one of the, I don't know if you call it these hangars or wherever the baggage was kept at Heathrow, warehouses, the padlock was cut on that night, so this bag with the bomb, and I think it was, as you suggest, an altitude bomb at a certain altitude, it goes off. So, I found a lot of evidence that shows a different, scenario for the Lockerbie bomb blast and the crash. So, if this man, Bernd Carlson, was the real target, then it explains why the cases he was bringing against the corporations suddenly disappeared, So whatever getting him out of the way as a target and a victim was very successful, because those cases were then dropped immediately. So it's a fascinating part of the book on its own.
Now, you mentioned various other individuals if I can just run through them, you mentioned some other individuals that you connect. So you've talked about Patrice Lumumba in 1961. You talked about Dag Hammarskjöld, the United Nations Secretary General, who was trying to stop armed insurrections in Africa, and that was in 1961 too. And Olof Palme, you mentioned him. Bernd Carlson. That's the guy we've just talked about. And what about this other chap, Anton Lebowski?
Lebowski. Now, he was a white advocate in Southwest Africa, or Namibia, as it became. And he joined SWAPO, which was the black, organization there, fighting, the white apartheid forces in Namibia. And he was hated, and he was similar to Chris Hani. He's almost his political twin. He was trying to...
Sorry, he said...
diamonds and all the...
He sounds like a hero. He sounds like a hero to me, but you say he was hated.
Yes, but he was hated by the whites, but he was a hero to the Vembos, to the Africans. And he was writing, and he was trying to, again, redistribute the wealth of Namibia, because it was being plundered by the corporates in that country. They were taking it out hand over fist, to the diamonds and uranium, etc., etc. So he was now advising Sam Nujoma, who was going to become the first president of Namibia, and he was advising him that there should be a redistribution of the wealth in Namibia. It should be shared amongst the population, because Namibia has got a relatively small population, probably then less than 3 million. So there was plenty of, minerals and resources to go around. And yet you know, these countries like South Africa, Namibia and them have the worst Gini coefficient in the world. You know, that's the gap between rich and poor. So what these people were trying to do was remedy that Gini coefficient, that gap between the rich and the poor. So they were then taken out to stop them doing that. And Anton Lebovsky, he was gunned down outside his house in the same way that Chris Harney was, I think on the 12th of September 1989. You know, the Lockerbie was the 21st of December 1988, you know, the midwinter 1988. And this Lebovsky guy was trying to do the same thing. He was trying to redistribute the wealth. He'd written a lot about it. He was detained a lot. He was an incredibly brave man, and so they just gunned him down. And Tony, something I must mention is that it seems to me that part of the African elite were joining forces with the colonialists and the corporates, because they had been bought and they were going to be the new leaders in the country and not try and go for a redistribution of the wealth.
Well, in a way, they're like traitors, aren't they? And of course, the Roman Empire used to do this. It would, when it invaded England in 43 AD, it was looking around for English people, or Britons, as they were then called, who would be collaborators like Quislings.
Sure. So, in each of the, with Chris Harney, there was a faction in the ANC that was working closely, with the old apartheid regime. They were trying to make sure that they got into power, but the things the whites, apartheid government and the people feared the most were what I call the two ends, nationalization of the economy and Nuremberg trials for all the horrors, all the people they tortured and killed. So this new faction in the ANC was happy to not have nationalization, not have Nuremberg trials. And so Harney was trying to redistribute the wealth and make sure those apartheid killers were brought to book, with Nuremberg trials. Why he was a public enemy number one to the whites.
Well, to certain of the whites, not to you, I hope. But how many of these murders, I mean, they're all assassinations, can you directly link to Saimar then?
That's a very interesting question because, this fascinating bundle of documents that I found had a list of the members of Saimar, and the man who killed Chris Harney, Janusz Waluś, there he is, number 99 on a typed list. So, this explained to me why Lumumba and Dag Hammarskjöld papers were in the Chris Harney file. It must have been purged, and somebody in the intelligence department must have not been very alert because he left those documents there. But those are the crucial documents that link Saimar with Harney, who died in 1993, and we've got Patrice Lumumba in 1960. So, over that 33-year period, we've got Saimar. Now, Saimar, if it is a branch of British intelligence, MI6, and was set up by them, you see that the some of the other killings seem to be linked to the British corporate sector. So, although Saimar isn't mentioned directly, you're talking about the same sort of forces at work.
Well, we have had in their retirement former MI6 people saying that the British were definitely behind the Lumumba assassination. You also mentioned this other group in your book called Le Cercle, which is a very far right group formed from a lot of them are ex intelligence officers. How are they involved, the Cercle? You say they're highly secret. In French, the Cercle.
Oh, now, they seem to have been a very secret organization which was made up of right-wing people from various politicians from Britain, I think America, France, South Africa, and they were linked up with apartheid generals and that. And they seem to meet every now and then and plan things. And they the minutes saying that this man, Olof Palme, you know, the Swedish Prime Minister, that he was a big nuisance, and blow me down if 18 months later or shorter, he was gunned down on the streets of Stockholm. I don't know if you remember the case of Olof Palme. He'd come back from the movies with his wife, and he was gunned down in the streets of Stockholm. So there seems to be a suggestion that Le Cercle had discussed his, you know, his demise. And, you know, one can't say they... But then there's very strong evidence that the South African intelligence agencies plotted the assassination of Olof Palme in Sweden. And their documents, which have been revealed, which showed chapter and verse how they planned it and how they were going to, you know, get there and get away and all that. So it's another secret organization similar to SIMAR, which is right-wing sort of people. You know, I assume some of the, you know, the Monday Club and those shadowy organizations of British conservative politicians.
Well, so can you point to any specific individual politicians here who may have been involved in the Harney murder or any of these other murders you've been looking at, these assassinations?
No. You know, it's difficult to find particular names. I don't know if you've ever... Somebody called Sir Patrick Wall, he was a British right-wing politician. He had lots of commercial interests in South Africa. According to Susan Williams, you know, she wrote those books, one about the Botswana, the president there marrying a white English girl, was made into a movie, United Kingdom. I don't know if you ever saw that, but Susan Williams, she has examined SIMAR, the South African, and linked it to Sir Patrick Wall, who was a great... fan of British naval history, and he called this secret organization SIMAR because it harked back to the days of British maritime wealth and fame, you know, when Britain ruled the waves in the, you know, in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's stuck in a bit of a fantasy. You also have a chapter about AIDS. How is that linked?
That is quite a ghastly part, Tony, in the sense that the SIMAR outfit was attempting to kill the black population by spreading AIDS. And a doctor who was part of SIMAR was planning, attending, or he went to a laboratory in the Congo where they were into devilish sort of plans. I mean, the most devilish was trying to take the enzyme that exists only in African people, join it to the AIDS virus, and put it in Congo flies and mosquitoes. So trying to spread AIDS by, you know, mosquitoes and flies and that. So there's quite a lot of documentation showing that in South Africa, Plan A was, let's see how many black people we can kill to try and bring down the numbers so that one day, if there's an election, you know, the blacks will have shrunk in numbers so that the whites will predominate. So there was clearly a mad group who were investigating and trying to carry out this killing of black people. Obviously, they didn't succeed because the numbers are still, you know, very substantial. I mean, 85 to 90% of South Africans are African.
Can you explain to listeners how they can get hold of the book, whereabouts to find it?
There's an e-book available on my website, which is chrisnicholson.co.za. The physical books are in South Africa. They've obviously been published in South Africa, and they're not available. I mean, they can be bought, the physical books, but they then have to be posted to England or wherever people want to buy the books. And, you know, if there's sufficient support or interest, I can see if I can get it published or printed in England, you know. So that's – but it's Chris Nicholson – you know, as the address I gave you, chrisnicholson@co.za.
And as a sort of final question, Chris, what about the links to the Israeli nuclear weapon program? Because I know that the South Africans were involved in that, weren't they?
You know, there seems to be some evidence, and I mentioned it briefly, of the Israelis being interested in the uranium from Namibia. So the interesting part of the case that Bernd Carlson, you know, the man who went down on the Lockerbie plane, he was actually bringing a case against Urenco, which is a British Dutch, I think, big company that deals in uranium, and the Israelis were very interested in the uranium supplies in Namibia. So there is some connection with the uranium in Namibia, and Bernd Carlson bringing that case.
Okay, Chris Nicholson, thanks very much for joining us.
chrisnicholson.co.za. Thank you very much.